only for an instant, like the flicker of an image after the eye is shut. Then there was only a swirling of black garments, a boot striking the stones, and the night was empty. I sat, panting, the sweat pouring down my face, staring around me and then up at the narrow ribbon of faint sky. Slowly, only because my eye was totally concentrated upon it now, a figure emerged from the darkness of the wall above me. Crouched on the jutting stones of the lintel, it turned so that I saw the barest gleam of light on the hair, and then this dark, white face. A strange face, broader and not so gaunt as the other. A large, dark eye that was holding me steadily. A whisper came from the lips, though they never appeared to move. "You are all right." I was more than all right. I was on my feet, ready to attack, but the figure remained crouched as if it were part of the wall. I could see a white hand working in what appeared to be a waistcoat pocket. A card appeared, white as the fingers that extended it to me. I didn't move to take it. "Come to us tomorrow night," said that same whisper from the smooth, expressionless face, which still showed only one eye to the light. "I won't harm you," he said, "and neither will that other. I won't allow it." And his hand did that thing which vampires can make happen. That is, it seemed to leave his body in the dark to deposit the card in my hand, the purple script immediately shining in the light, and the figure, moving upwards like a cat on the wall, vanished fast between the garret gables overhead. I knew I was alone now, could feel it, and the pounding of my heart seemed to fill the empty little street as I stood under the lamp reading that card. The address I knew well enough, because I had been to theatres along that street more than once, but the name was astonishing. Théâtre des Vampires. And the time noted, 9 p.m. I turned it over and discovered, written there, the note, "Bring the petite beauty with you. You are most welcome, Armand." There was no doubt that the figure who'd given it to me had written this message, and I had only a very short time to get to the hotel and to tell Claudia of these things before dawn. I was running fast, so that even the people I passed on the boulevards did not actually see the shadow that brushed them. The Théâtre des Vampires was by invitation only, and the next night the doorman inspected my card for a moment while the rain fell softly all around us, on the man and the woman stopped at the shut-up box office, on the crinkling posters of penny dreadful vampires with their outstretched arms and cloaks resembling bat wings, ready to close on the naked shoulders of a mortal victim, on the couple that pressed past us into the packed lobby, where I could easily perceive that the crowd was all human, no vampires among them. Not even this boy who admitted us finally into the press of conversation and damp wool and ladies' gloved fingers fumbling with felt-brimmed hats and wet curls. I pressed for the shadows in a feverish excitement. We had fed earlier only so that in the bustling street of this theatre our skin would not be too white, our eyes too unclouded. And that taste of blood which I had not enjoyed had left me all the more uneasy. But I had no time for it. This was no night for killing. This was to be a night of revelations. No matter how it ended, I was certain. Yet here we stood with this all-too-human crowd, the doors opening now on the auditorium, and a young boy pushing towards us, beckoning, pointing above the shoulders of the crowd to the stairs. Ours was a box, one of the best in the house, and if the blood had not dimmed my skin completely, nor made Claudia into a human child as she rode in my arms, this usher did not seem at all to notice it, nor to care. In fact, he smiled all too readily as he drew back the curtain for us on two chairs before the brass rail. "Would you put it past them to have human slaves?" Claudia whispered. "But Lestat never trusted human slaves," I answered. I watched the seats fill, watched the marvellously flowered hats navigating below me through the rows of silk chairs. White shoulders gleamed in the deep curve of the balcony spreading out from us. Diamonds glittered in the gaslight. "Remember, be sly for once," came Claudia's whisper from beneath her bowed blonde head. "You're too much of a gentleman." The lights were going out, first in the balcony and then along the walls of the main floor. A knot of musicians had gathered in the pit below the stage, and at the foot of the long green velvet curtain the gas flickered, then brightened, and the audience receded as if enveloped by a grey cloud through which only the diamonds sparkled on wrists, on throats, on fingers. And a hush descended like that grey cloud, until all the sound was collected in one echoing, persistent cough. Then silence, and the slow, rhythmical beating of a tambourine. Added to that was the thin melody of a wooden flute, which seemed to pick up the sharp metallic tink of the bells of the tambourine, winding them into a haunting melody that was medieval in sound. Then the strumming of strings that emphasized the tambourine, and the flute rose in that melody singing to something melancholy, sad. It had a charm to it, this music, and the whole audience seemed stilled and united by it, as if the music of that flute were a luminous ribbon unfurling slowly in the dark. Not even the rising curtain broke the silence with the slightest sound. The lights brightened, and it seemed the stage was not the stage, but a thickly wooded place, the light glittering on the roughened tree trunks and the thick clusters of leaves beneath the arch of darkness above. And through the trees could be seen what appeared the low stone bank of a river, and above that, beyond that, the glittering waters of the river itself. This whole three-dimensional world, produced in painting upon a fine silk screen that shivered only slightly in a faint draught. A sprinkling of applause greeted the illusion, gathering adherents from all parts of the auditorium until it reached its short crescendo and died away. A dark, draped figure was moving on the stage from tree trunk to tree trunk, so fast that as he stepped into the lights he seemed to appear magically in the center, one arm flashing out from his cloak to show a silver scythe, and the other to hold a mask on a slender stick before the invisible face, a mask which showed the gleaming countenance of death, a painted skull. There were gasps from the crowd. It was Death standing before the audience, the scythe poised, Death at the edge of a dark wood. And something in me was responding now as the audience responded, not in fear, but in some human way, to the magic of that fragile, painted set, the mystery of the lighted world there, the world in which this figure moved in his billowing black cloak, back and forth before the audience with the grace of a great panther, drawing forth, as it were, those gasps, those sighs, those reverent murmurs. And now, behind this figure, whose very gestures seemed to have a captivating power, like the rhythm of the music to which it moved, came other figures from the wings. First an old woman, very stooped and bent, her grey hair like moss, her arm hanging down with the weight of a great basket of flowers. Her shuttling steps scraped on the stage, and her head bobbed with the rhythm of the music and the darting steps of the grim reaper. And then she started back as she laid eyes on him, and, slowly setting down her basket, made her hands into the attitude of prayer. She was tired. Her head leaned now on her hands as if in sleep, and she reached out for him, supplicating. But as he came towards her, he bent to look directly into her face, which was all shadows to us beneath her hair, and started back then, waving his hand as if to freshen the air. Laughter erupted uncertainly from the audience, but as the old woman rose and took after Death, the laughter took over. The music broke into a jig with their running, as round and round the stage the old woman pursued Death, until he finally flattened himself into the dark of a tree trunk, bowing his masked face under his wing like a bird. And the old woman, lost, defeated, gathered up her basket as the music softened and slowed to her pace, and made her way off the stage. I did not like it. I did not like the laughter. I could see the other figures moving in now, the music orchestrating their gestures. Cripples on crutches, and beggars with rags the color of ash, all reaching out for death, who whirled, escaping this one with a sudden arching of the back, fleeing from that one with an effeminate gesture of disgust, waving them all away finally in a foppish display of weariness and boredom. It was then I realized that the languid white hand that made these comic arcs was not painted white. It was a vampire hand which wrung laughter from the crowd, a vampire hand lifted now to the grinning skull as the stage was finally clear, as if stifling a yawn. And then this vampire, still holding the mask before his face, adopted marvelously the attitude of resting his weight against a painted silken tree as if he were falling gently to sleep. The music twittered like birds, rippled like the flowing of the water, and the spotlight which encircled him in a yellow pool grew dim, all but fading away as he slept. And another spot pierced this scrim, seeming to melt it altogether, to reveal a young woman standing alone far upstage. She was majestically tall, and all but enshrined by a voluminous mane of golden blonde hair. I could feel the awe of the audience as she seemed to flounder in the spotlight, the dark forest rising on the perimeter, so that she seemed to be lost in the trees. And she was lost, and not a vampire. The soil on her mean blouse and skirt was not stage paint, and nothing had touched her perfect face, which gazed into the light now, as beautiful and finely chiseled as the face of a marble virgin, that hair, her haloed veil. She could not see in the light, though all could see her, and the moan which escaped her lips as she floundered seemed to echo over the thin, romantic singing of the flute, which was a tribute to that beauty. The figure of death woke with a start in his pale spotlight and turned to see her as the audience had seen her, and to throw up his free hand in tribute, in awe. The twitter of laughter died before it became real. She was too beautiful, her grey eyes too distressed, the performance too perfect. And then the skull mask was thrown suddenly into the wings, and Death showed a beaming white face to the audience, his hurried hands stroking his handsome black hair, straightening a waistcoat, brushing imaginary dust from his lapels. Death in love. And clapping rose for the luminous countenance, the gleaming cheekbones, the winking black eye, as if it were all masterful illusion, when in fact it was merely and certainly the face of a vampire. The vampire who had accosted me in the Latin Quarter, that leering, grinning vampire, harshly illuminated by the yellow spot. My hand reached for Claudia's in the dark and pressed it tightly, but she sat still as if enwrapped. The forest of the stage, through which that helpless mortal girl stared blindly towards the laughter, divided in two phantom halves, moving away from the centre, freeing the vampire to close in on her. And she who had been advancing towards the footlights saw him suddenly, and came to a halt, making a moan like a child. Indeed, she was very like a child, though clearly a full-grown woman. Only a slight wrinkling of the tender flesh around her eyes betrayed her age. Her breasts, though small, were beautifully shaped beneath her blouse, and her hips, though narrow, gave her long, dusty skirt a sharp, sensual angularity. As she moved back from the vampire, I saw the tears standing in her eyes like glass in the flicker of the lights, and I felt my spirit contract in fear for her, and in longing. Her beauty was heartbreaking. Behind her, a number of painted skulls suddenly moved against the blackness, the figures that carried the masks, invisible in their black clothes, except for free white hands that clasped the edge of a cape, the folds of a skirt. Vampire women were there, moving in with the men towards the victim, and now they all, one by one, thrust the masks away so they fell in an artful pile, the sticks like bones, the skulls grinning into the darkness above.
And there they stood, seven vampires, the woman vampires, three in number, their moulded white breasts shining over the tight black bodices of their gowns, their hard, luminescent faces staring with dark eyes beneath curls of black hair.
Starkly beautiful, as they seemed to float close around that florid human figure, yet pale and cold compared to that sparkling golden hair, that petal-pink skin. I could hear the breath of the audience, the halting, the soft sighs. It was a spectacle, that circle of white faces pressing closer and closer, and that leading figure, that gentleman Death, turning to the audience now with his hands crossed over his heart, his head bent in longing to elicit their sympathy. Was she not irresistible? A murmur of assenting laughter, of sighs. But it was she who broke the magic silence. "I don't want to die," she whispered. Her voice was like a bell. "We are Death," he answered her. And from around her came the whisper, "Death." She turned, tossing her hair so it became a veritable shower of gold, a rich and living thing over the dust of her poor clothing. "Help me," she cried out softly, as if afraid even to raise her voice. "Someone," she said to the crowd she knew must be there. A soft laughter came from Claudia. The girl on stage only vaguely understood where she was, what was happening, but knew infinitely more than this house of people that gaped at her. "I don't want to die! I don't want to!" her delicate voice broke, her eyes fixed on the tall, malevolent leader vampire, that demon trickster who now stepped out of the circle of the others towards her. "We all die," he answered her. "The one thing you share with every mortal is death." His hand took in the orchestra, the distant faces of the balcony, the boxes.
"No," she protested in disbelief. "I have so many years, so many."
Her voice was light, lilting in her pain. It made her irresistible, just as did the movement of her naked throat and the hand that fluttered there.
"Years," said the master vampire. "How do you know you have so many years? Death is no respecter of age. There could be a sickness in your body now, already devouring you from within, or outside, a man might be waiting to kill you simply for your yellow hair."
And his fingers reached for it, the sound of his deep, preternatural voice sonorous.
"Need I tell what fate may have in store for you?"
"I don't care. I'm not afraid," she protested, her clarion voice so fragile after him. "I would take my chance."
"And if you do take that chance, and live, live for years, what would be your heritage? The hump-backed, toothless visage of old age?"
And now he lifted her hair behind her back, exposing her pale throat. And slowly he drew the string from the loose gathers of her blouse. The cheap fabric opened, the sleeves slipping off her narrow pink shoulders, and she clasped it, only to have him take her wrists and thrust them sharply away. The audience seemed to sigh in a body. The women behind their opera glasses, the men leaning forward in their chairs. I could see the cloth falling, see the pale, flawless skin pulsing with her heart, and the tiny nipples letting the cloth slip precariously. The vampire holding her right wrist tightly at her side, the tears coursing down her blushing cheeks, her teeth biting into the flesh of her lip.
"Just as sure as this flesh is pink, it will turn grey, wrinkled with age,"
he said.
"Let me live, please," she begged, her face turning away from him. "I don't care. I don't care."
"But then why should you care if you die now? If these things don't frighten you, these horrors?"
She shook her head, baffled, outsmarted, helpless. I felt the anger in my veins as sure as the passion. With a bowed head, she bore the whole responsibility for defending life. And it was unfair, monstrously unfair, that she should have to pit logic against his for what was obvious and sacred and so beautifully embodied in her. But he made her speechless, made her overwhelming instinct seem petty, confused. I could feel her dying inside, weakening, and I hated him. The blouse slipped to her waist. A murmur moved through the titillated crowd as her small, round breasts stood exposed. She struggled to free her wrist, but he held it fast.
"And suppose we were to let you go? Suppose the Grim Reaper had a heart that could resist your beauty? To whom would he turn his passion? Someone must die in your place. Would you pick the person for us? The person to stand here and suffer as you suffer now?" He gestured to the audience. Her confusion was terrible. "Have you a sister? A mother? A child?"
"No," she gasped. "No,"
shaking the mane of hair.
"Surely someone could take your place. A friend? Choose."
"I can't. I wouldn't."
She writhed in his tight grasp. The vampires around her looked on, still, their faces evincing no emotion, as if the preternatural flesh were masks.
"Can't you do it?" he taunted her.
And I knew, if she said she could, how he would only condemn her, say she was as evil as he for marking someone for death, say that she deserved her fate.
"Death waits for you everywhere."
He sighed now, as if he were suddenly frustrated. The audience could not perceive it. I could. I could see the muscles of his smooth face tightening. He was trying to keep her grey eyes on his eyes, but she looked desperately, hopefully away from him. On the warm, rising air I could smell the dust and perfume of her skin, hear the soft beating of her heart.
"Unconscious death, the fate of all mortals."
He bent closer to her, musing, infatuated with her, but struggling.
But we are conscious death. That would make you a bride. Do you know what it means to be loved by death?"
He all but kissed her face, the brilliant stain of her tears.
"Do you know what it means to have death know your name?"
She looked at him, overcome with fear. And then her eyes seemed to mist over, her lips to go slack. She was staring past him at the figure of another vampire who had emerged slowly from the shadows. For a long time he had stood on the periphery of the gathering, his hands clasped, his large, dark eyes very still. His attitude was not the attitude of hunger. He did not appear rapt. But she was looking into his eyes now, and her pain bathed her in a beauteous light, a light which made her irresistibly alluring. It was this that held the jaded audience, this terrible pain. I could feel her skin, feel the small, pointed breasts, feel my arms caressing her. I shut my eyes against it and saw her starkly against that private darkness. It was what they felt all around her, this community of vampires. She had no chance. And, looking up again, I saw her shimmering in the smoky light of the footlamps, saw her tears like gold, as soft from that other vampire who stood at a distance came the words, "No pain." I could see the trickster stiffen, but no one else would see it. They would see only the girl's smooth, childlike face, those parted lips, slack with innocent wonder as she gazed at that distant vampire, hear her soft voice repeat after him, "No pain?"
"Your beauty is a gift to us."
His rich voice effortlessly filled the house, seemed to fix and subdue the mounting wave of excitement. And slightly, almost imperceptibly, his hand moved. The trickster was receding, becoming one of those patient white faces whose hunger and equanimity were strangely one, and slowly, gracefully, the other moved towards her. She was languid, her nakedness forgotten, those lids fluttering, a sigh escaping her moist lips.
"No pain,"
she assented. I could hardly bear it, the sight of her yearning towards him, seeing her dying now under this vampire's power. I wanted to cry out to her, to break her swoon, and I wanted her. Wanted her, as he was moving in on her, his hand out now for the drawstring of her skirt, as she inclined towards him, her head back, the black cloth slipping over her hips, over a golden gleam of the hair between her legs, a child's down, that delicate girl, the skirt dropping to her feet. And this vampire opened his arms, his back to the flickering footlights, his auburn hair seeming to tremble as the gold of her hair fell around his black coat.
"No pain, no pain,"
he was whispering to her, and she was giving herself over. And now, turning her slowly to the side so that they could all see her serene face, he was lifting her, her back arching as her naked breast touched his buttons, her pale arms enfolded his neck. She stiffened, cried out as he sank his teeth, and her face was still as the dark theatre reverberated with shared passion. His white hand shone on her florid buttocks, her hair dusting it, stroking it. He lifted her off the boards as he drank, her throat gleaming against his white cheek. I felt weak, dazed, hunger rising in me, knotting my heart, my veins. I felt my hand gripping the brass bar of the box tighter, until I could feel the metal creaking in its joints, and that soft, wrenching sound which none of those mortals might hear seemed somehow to hook me to the solid place where I was. I bowed my head. I wanted to shut my eyes. The air seemed fragrant with her salted skin, and close and hot and sweet. Around her the other vampires drew in. The white hand that held her tight quivered, and the auburn-haired vampire let her go, turning her, displaying her. Her head fallen back as he gave her over, one of those starkly beautiful vampire women rising behind her, cradling her, stroking her as she bent to drink. They were all about her now, as she was passed from one to another and to another before the enthralled crowd, her head thrown forward over the shoulder of a vampire man, the nape of her neck as enticing as the small buttocks or the flawless skin of her long thighs, the tender creases behind her limply bent knees. I was sitting back in the chair, my mouth full of the taste of her, my veins in torment. And in the corner of my eye was that auburn-haired vampire who had conquered her, standing apart as he had been before, his dark eyes seeming to pick me from the darkness, seeming to fix on me over the currents of warm air. One by one the vampires were withdrawing. The painted forest came back, sliding soundlessly into place, until the mortal girl, frail and very white, lay naked in that mysterious wood, nestled in the silk of a black bier as if on the floor of the forest itself, and the music had begun again, eerie and alarming, growing louder as the lights grew dimmer. All the vampires were gone, except the trickster, who had gathered his scythe from the shadows and also his hand-held mask. and he crouched near the sleeping girl as the lights slowly faded and the music alone had power and force in the enclosing dark. And then that died also. For a moment, the entire crowd was utterly still. Then applause began here and there, and suddenly united everyone around us. The lights rose in the sconces on the walls, and heads turned to one another, conversation erupting all round. A woman rising in the middle of a row to pull her fox fur sharply from the chair, though no one had yet made way for her. Someone else pushing out quickly to the carpeted aisle, and the whole body was on its feet as if driven to the exits. But then the hum became the comfortable, jaded hum of the sophisticated and perfumed crowd that had filled the lobby and the vault of the theatre before. The spell was broken. The doors were flung open on the fragrant rain, the clop of horses' hooves, and voices calling for taxis. Down in the sea of slightly askew chairs, a white glove gleamed on a green silk cushion. I sat watching, listening, one hand shielding my lowered face from anyone and no one, my elbow resting on the rail, the passion in me subsiding, the taste of the girl on my lips. It was as though on the smell of the rain came her perfume still, and in the empty theatre I could hear the throb of her beating heart. I sucked in my breath, tasted the rain, and glimpsed Claudia sitting infinitely still, her gloved hands in her lap. There was a bitter taste in my mouth, and confusion. And then I saw a lone usher moving on the aisle below, righting the chairs, reaching for the scattered programs that littered the carpet. I was aware that this ache in me, this confusion, this blinding passion which only let me go with a stubborn slowness would be obliterated if I were to drop down to one of those curtained archways beside him and draw him up fast in the darkness and take him as that girl was taken. I wanted to do it, and I wanted nothing. Claudia said near my bowed ear, "Patience, Louis, patience." I opened my eyes. Someone was near, on the periphery of my vision. Someone who had outsmarted my hearing, my keen anticipation, which penetrated like a sharp antenna even this distraction, or so I thought. But there he was, soundless, beyond the curtained entrance of the box, that vampire with the auburn hair, that detached one standing on the carpeted stairway looking at us. I knew him now to be, as I'd suspected, the vampire who had given me the card admitting us to the theatre, Armand. He would have startled me except for his stillness, the remote, dreamy quality of his expression. It seemed he'd been standing against that wall for the longest time and betrayed no sign of change as we looked at him, then came towards him. Had he not so completely absorbed me, I would have been relieved he was not the tall, black-haired one. But I didn't think of this. Now his eyes moved languidly over Claudia, with no tribute whatsoever to the human habit of disguising the stare. I placed my hand on Claudia's shoulder. "We've been searching for you a very long time," I said to him, my heart growing calmer, as if his calm were drawing off my trepidation, my care, like the sea drawing something into itself from the land. I cannot exaggerate this quality in him, yet I can't describe it, and couldn't then, and the fact that my mind sought to describe it, even to myself, unsettled me. He gave me the very feeling that he knew what I was doing, and his still posture and his deep brown eyes seemed to say there was no use in what I was thinking, or particularly the words I was struggling to form now. Claudia said nothing. He moved away from the wall and began to walk down the stairs, while at the same time he made a gesture that welcomed us and bade us follow. But all this was fluid and fast. My gestures were the caricature of human gestures compared to his. He opened a door in the lower wall and admitted us to the rooms below the theatre, his feet only brushing the stone stairway as we descended, his back to us with complete trust. and now we entered what appeared to be a vast, subterranean ballroom, carved, as it were, out of a cellar more ancient than the building overhead. Above us, the door that he had opened fell shut, and the light died away before I could get a fair impression of the room. I heard the rustle of his garments in the dark, and then the sharp explosion of a match. His face appeared like a great flame over the match, and then a figure moved into the light beside him, a young boy who brought him a candle. The sight of the boy brought back to me in a shock the teasing pleasure of the naked woman on the stage, her prone body, the pulsing blood. And he turned and gazed at me now, much in the manner of the auburn-haired vampire who had lit the candle, and whispered to him, "Go." The light expanded to the distant walls, and the vampire held the light up and moved along the wall, beckoning us both to follow. I could see a world of frescoes and murals surrounded us, their colors deep and vibrant above the dancing flame, and gradually the theme and content beside us came clear. It was the terrible Triumph of Death by Bruegel, painted on such a massive scale that all the multitude of ghastly figures towered over us in the gloom, those ruthless skeletons ferrying the helpless dead in a fetid moat, or pulling a cart of human skulls, beheading an outstretched corpse, or hanging humans from the gallows. A bell tolled over the endless hell of scorched and smoking land, towards which great armies of men came with a hideous, mindless march of soldiers to a massacre. I turned away, but the auburn-haired one touched my hand and led me further along the wall to see the fall of the angels slowly materializing, with the damned being driven from the celestial heights into a lurid chaos of feasting monsters. So vivid, so perfect was it, I shuddered. The hand that had touched me did the same again, and I stood still despite it, deliberately looking above to the very height of the mural, where I could make out of the shadows two beautiful angels with trumpets to their lips. And for a second the spell was broken. I had the strong sense of the first evening I had entered Notre Dame, but then that was gone, like something gossamer and precious snatched away from me. The candle rose, and horrors rose all around me. The dumbly passive and degraded damned of Bosch, the bloated coffined corpses of Traigny, the monstrous horsemen of Dürer, and blown out of all endurable scale a promenade of medieval woodcut, emblem and engraving. The very ceiling writhed with skeletons and mouldering dead, with demons and the instruments of pain, as if this were the cathedral of death itself. Where we stood finally in the center of the room, the candle seemed to pull the images to life everywhere around us. Delirium threatened. That awful shifting of the room began, that sense of falling. I reached out for Claudia's hand. She stood musing, her face passive, her eyes distant when I looked to her, as if she'd have me let her alone. And then her feet shot off from me with a rapid tapping on the stone floor that echoed all along the walls, like fingers tapping on my temples, on my skull. I held my temples, staring dumbly at the floor in search of shelter, as if to lift my eyes would force me to look on some wretched suffering I would not, could not endure. Then again I saw the vampire's face floating in his flame, his ageless eyes circled in dark lashes. His lips were very still, but as I stared at him he seemed to smile without making even the slightest movement. I watched him all the harder, convinced it was some powerful illusion I could penetrate with keen attention, and the more I watched, the more he seemed to smile and finally to be animated with a soundless whispering, musing, singing. I could hear it like something curling in the dark, as wallpaper curls in the blast of a fire, or paint peels from the face of a burning doll. I had the urge to reach for him, to shake him violently so that his still face would move, admit to this soft singing. And suddenly I found him pressed against me, his arm around my chest, his lashes so close I could see them matted and gleaming above the incandescent orb of his eye, his soft, tasteless breath against my skin. It was delirium. I moved to get away from him, and yet I was drawn to him, and I didn't move at all, his arm exerting its firm pressure, his candle blazing now against my eye, so that I felt the warmth of it. All my cold flesh yearned for that warmth. But suddenly I waved to snuff it, but couldn't find it, and all I saw was his radiant face, as I had never seen Lestat's face, white and poreless, and sinewy and male. The other vampire. All other vampires. An infinite procession of my own kind. The moment ended. I found myself with my hand outstretched, touching his face, but he was a distance away from me, as if he'd never moved near me, making no attempt to brush my hand away. I drew back, flushed, stunned. Far away in the Paris night a bell chimed, the dull golden circles of sound seeming to penetrate the walls, the timbers that carried that sound down into the earth like great organ pipes. Again came that whispering, that inarticulate singing. And through the gloom I saw that mortal boy watching me, and I smelled the hot aroma of his flesh. The vampire's facile hand beckoned him, and he came towards me, his eyes fearless and exciting, and he drew up to me in the candlelight and put his arms around my shoulders. Never had I felt this. Never had I experienced it, this yielding of a conscious mortal. But before I could push him away for his own sake, I saw the bluish bruise on his tender neck. He was offering it to me. He was pressing the length of his body against me now, and I felt the hard strength of his sex beneath his clothes pressing against my leg. A wretched gasp escaped my lips, but he bent close, his lips on what must have been so cold, so lifeless for him, and I sank my teeth into his skin, my body rigid, that hard sex driving against me, and I lifted him in passion off the floor. Wave after wave of his beating heart passed into me as, weightless, I rocked with him, devouring him, his ecstasy, his conscious pleasure. Then, weak and gasping, I saw him at a distance from me, my arms empty, my mouth still flooded with a taste of his blood. He lay against that auburn-haired vampire, his arm about the vampire's waist, and he gazed at me in that same pacific manner of the vampire, his eyes misted over and weak from the loss of life. I remember moving mutely forward, drawn to him and seemingly unable to control it, that gaze taunting me, that conscious life defying me. He should die and would not die. He would live on, comprehending, surviving that intimacy. I turned. The host of vampires moved in the shadows, their candles whipped and fleeting on the cool air, and above them loomed a great broadcast of ink-drawn figures, the sleeping corpse of a woman ravaged by a vulture with a human face, a naked man bound hand and foot to a tree, beside him hanging the torso of another, his severed arms tied still to another branch, and on a spike this dead man's staring head. The singing came again, that thin, ethereal singing. Slowly the hunger in me subsided, obeyed, but my head throbbed and the flames of the candles seemed to merge in burnished circles of light. Someone touched me suddenly, pushed me roughly, so that I almost lost my balance, and when I straightened I saw the thin, angular face of the trickster vampire I despised. He reached out for me with his white hands. But the other one, the distant one, moved forward suddenly and stood between us. It seemed he struck the other vampire, that I saw him move, and then again I did not see him move. Both stood still like statues, eyes fixed on one another, and time passed like wave after wave of water rolling back from a still beach. I cannot say how long we stood there, the three of us in those shadows, and how utterly still they seemed to me, only the shimmering flames seeming to have life behind them. Then I remember floundering along the wall and finding a large oak chair into which I all but collapsed. It seemed Claudia was near and speaking to someone in a hushed but sweet voice. My forehead teemed with blood, with heat. "Come with me," said the auburn-haired vampire. I was searching his face for the movement of his lips that must have preceded the sound, yet it was so hopelessly long after the sound. And then we were walking, the three of us, down a long stone stairway deeper beneath the city, Claudia ahead of us, her shadow long against the wall. The air grew cool and refreshing with the fragrance of water, and I could see the droplets bleeding through the stones like beads of gold in the light of the vampire's candle. It was a small chamber we entered, a fire burning in a deep fireplace cut into the stone wall. A bed lay at the other end, fitted into the rock and enclosed with two brass gates. At first I saw these things clearly, and saw the long wall of books opposite the fireplace, and the wooden desk that was against it, and the coffin to the other side. But then the room began to waver, and the auburn-haired vampire put his hands on my shoulders and guided me down into a leather chair. The fire was intensely hot against my legs. But this felt good to me, sharp and clear, something to draw me out of this confusion. I sat back, my eyes only half open, and tried to see again what was about me. It was as if that distant bed were a stage, and on the linen pillows of the little stage lay that boy, his black hair parted in the middle and curling about his ears, so that he looked now in his dreamy, fevered state like one of those lithe, androgynous creatures of a Botticelli painting. And beside him, nestled against him, her tiny white hand stark against his ruddy flesh, lay Claudia, her face buried in his neck. The masterful, auburn-haired vampire looked on, his hands clasped in front of him. And when Claudia rose now, the boy shuddered. The vampire picked her up, gently, as I might pick her up, her hands finding a hold on his neck, her eyes half shut with a swoon, her lips rouged with blood. He set her gently on the desk, and she lay back against the leather-bound books, her hands falling gracefully into the lap of her lavender dress. The gates closed on the boy, and burying his face in the pillows, he slept. There was something disturbing to me in the room, and I didn't know what it was. I didn't in truth know what was wrong with me, only that I'd been drawn forcefully either by myself or someone else from two fierce, consuming states. An absorption with those grim paintings, and the kill to which I'd abandoned myself obscenely in the eyes of others. I didn't know what it was that threatened me now, what it was that my mind sought escape from. I kept looking at Claudia, the way she lay against the books, the way she sat amongst the objects of the desk, the polished white skull, the candle holder, the open parchment book whose hand-painted script gleamed in the light. And then above her there emerged into focus the lacquered and shimmering painting of a medieval devil, horned and hoofed, his bestial figure looming over a coven of worshipping witches. Her head was just beneath it, the loose curling strands of her hair just stroking it, and she watched the brown-eyed vampire with wide, wondering eyes. I wanted to pick her up suddenly and frightfully, horribly, I saw her in my kindled imagination flopping like a doll. I was gazing at the devil, that monstrous face preferable to the sight of her in her eerie stillness. "You won't awaken the boy if you speak," said the brown-eyed vampire. "You've come from so far. You've travelled so long. and gradually my confusion subsided, as if smoke were rising and moving away on a current of fresh air, and I lay awake and very calm, looking at him as he sat in the opposite chair. Claudia, too, looked at him, and he looked from one to the other of us, his smooth face and pacific eyes very like they'd been all along, as though there had never been any change in him at all. "My name is Armand," he said. "I sent Santiago to give you the invitation. I know your names. I welcome you to my house." I gathered my strength to speak, my voice sounding strange to me when I told him that we had feared we were alone. "But how did you come into existence?" he asked. Claudia's hand rose ever so slightly from her lap, her eyes moving mechanically from his face to mine. I saw this, and knew that he must have seen it, and yet he gave no sign. I knew at once what she meant to tell me. "You don't want to answer," said Armand, his voice low and even more measured than Claudia's voice, far less human than my own. I sensed myself slipping away again into contemplation of that voice and those eyes, from which I had to draw myself up with great effort. "Are you the leader of this group?" I asked him.
"Not in the way you mean, leader," he answered. "But if there were a leader here, I would be that one."
"I haven't come, you'll forgive me, to talk of how I came into being, because that's no mystery to me, it presents no question. So if you have no power to which I might be required to render respect, I don't wish to talk of those things."
"If I told you I did have such power, would you respect it?" he asked.
I wish I could describe his manner of speaking, how each time he spoke, he seemed to arise out of a state of contemplation very like that state into which I felt I was drifting, from which it took so much to wrench myself, and yet he never moved, and seemed at all times alert. This distracted me, while at the same time I was powerfully attracted by it, as I was by this room, its simplicity, its rich, warm combination of essentials, the books, the desk, the two chairs by the fire, the coffin, the pictures. The luxury of those rooms in the hotel seemed vulgar, but more than that, meaningless beside this room. I understood all of it, except for the mortal boy, the sleeping boy, whom I didn't understand at all. "I'm not certain," I said, unable to keep my eyes off that awful medieval Satan. "I would have to know from whom it comes, whether it came from other vampires or elsewhere."
"Elsewhere," he said. "What is elsewhere?"
"That," I pointed to the medieval picture.
"That is a picture," he said.
"Nothing more?"
"Nothing more."
"Then Satan, some satanic power, doesn't give you your power here, either as leader or as vampire?"
"No,"
he said calmly, so calmly it was impossible for me to know what he thought of my questions, if he thought of them at all in the manner which I knew to be thinking.
"And the other vampires?"
"No," he said. "Then we are not," I sat forward. "The children of Satan?"
"How could we be the children of Satan?" he asked. "Do you believe that Satan made this world around you?"
"No. I believe that God made it, if anyone made it. But he also must have made Satan, and I want to know if we are his children."
"Exactly. And consequently, if you believe God made Satan, you must realize that all Satan's power comes from God, and that Satan is simply God's child, and that we are God's children also. There are no children of Satan, really."
I couldn't disguise my feelings at this. I sat back against the leather, looking at that small woodcut of the devil, released for the moment from any sense of obligation to Armand's presence, lost in my thoughts, in the undeniable implications of his simple logic.
But why does this concern you?
Surely what I say doesn't surprise you, he said.
Why do you let it affect you?
Let me explain, I began. I know that you're a master vampire. I respect you. But I'm incapable of your detachment. I know what it is, and I do not possess it, and I doubt that I ever will. I accept this.
I understand, he nodded. I saw you in the theater. Your suffering, your sympathy with that girl. I saw your sympathy for Denis when I offered him to you. You die when you kill, as if you feel that you deserve to die, and you stint on nothing. But why, with this passion and this sense of justice, do you wish to call yourself the child of Satan?
I'm evil. Evil as any vampire who ever lived. I've killed over and over, and will do it again. I took that boy, Denis, when you gave him to me, though I was incapable of knowing whether he would survive or not.
Why does that make you as evil as any vampire? Aren't there gradations of evil? Is evil a great perilous gulf into which one falls with the first sin, plummeting to the depth?
Yes, I think it is, I said to him. It's not logical, as you would make it sound, but it's that dark, that empty, and it is without consolation.
But you're not being fair, he said, with the first glimmer of expression in his voice. Surely you attribute great degrees and variations to goodness. There is the goodness of the child, which is innocence, and then there is the goodness of the monk, who has given up everything to others and lives a life of self-deprivation and service, the goodness of saints, the goodness of good housewives. Are all these the same?
No, but equally and infinitely different from evil, I answered. I didn't know I thought these things. I spoke them now as my thoughts, and they were my most profound feelings, taking a shape they could never have taken had I not spoken them, had I not thought them out this way in conversation with another. I thought myself then possessed of a passive mind, in a sense. I mean that my mind could only pull itself together, formulate thought out of the muddle of longing and pain, when it was touched by another mind, fertilized by it, deeply excited by that other mind and driven to form conclusions. I felt now the rarest, most acute alleviation of loneliness. I could easily visualize and suffer that moment years before in another century, when I had stood at the foot of Babette's stairway, and feel the perpetual, metallic frustration of years with Lestat, and then that passionate and doomed affection for Claudia which made loneliness retreat behind the soft indulgence of the senses, the same senses that longed for the kill. And I saw the desolate mountain top in Eastern Europe, where I had confronted that mindless vampire and killed him in the monastery ruins. And it was as if the great feminine longing of my mind were being awakened again to be satisfied. And this I felt despite my own words. But it's that dark, that empty, and it is without consolation. I looked at Armand, at his large brown eyes in that taut, timeless face, watching me again like a painting, and I felt the slow shifting of the physical world I'd felt in the painted ballroom, the pull of my old delirium, the wakening of a need so terrible that the very promise of its fulfillment contained the unbearable possibility of disappointment. And yet there was the question, the awful, ancient, hounding question of evil. I think I put my hands to my head, as mortals do when so deeply troubled that they instinctively cover the face, reach for the brain as if they could reach through the skull and massage the living organ out of its agony.
"And how is this evil achieved?" he asked. "How does one fall from grace and become in one instant as evil as the mob tribunal of the revolution, or the most cruel of the Roman emperors? Does one merely have to miss Mass on Sunday? Or bite down on the communion host? Or steal a loaf of bread? Or sleep with a neighbor's wife?"
"No," I shook my head.
No. But if evil is without gradation, and it does exist, this state of evil,